All right, would you all turn with me to the book of Esther? We're going to be looking at Esther chapter 7 this evening. Esther chapter 7. And just to kind of give a quick recap, so if you remember, Haman, the antagonist of the story, he at one point realizes Mordecai, the Jew, has not been bowing to him. It infuriates Haman, and so what he does is he plans to get the king to give him the ability to eradicate all of the Jewish people, including Mordecai, and the king really doesn't think much about it, but he basically gives Haman the go-ahead, gives him his signet ring, and so Haman goes and gets this edict to pass through Persia. Basically, all the Jews are going to be killed in about 11 months, and because of this, we see that the Jewish people, they're mourning. Mordecai is going by the king, the outer part of the king's gates. He's mourning, wearing sackcloth and ashes. The city is perplexed. They don't know what's going on. All of this is happening. Esther finds out that Mordecai's been mourning, and so there's this ongoing back and forth of sending a eunuch to discuss what's happening. And then ultimately, Mordecai convinces Esther to go to the king, which would have been against Persian law to do, to approach the king and to intercede for her people. And so Esther basically says, okay, I'm going to do this. And so what we saw last time is Esther went into the courts of the king and was waiting, standing there, and the king actually extends the scepter to her, which that would basically mean he accepted her and wasn't going to have her executed for coming before him without being summoned. And then he basically actually ends up being very generous, and he's like, what would you like? I'll give you anything up to half of my kingdom. And then we're expecting that maybe Esther's going to just explain, hey, my people are about to be killed, will you save us? But instead she says, I have a feast prepared, and I'd like you and Haman, your second in command, to come to the feast. And so we're like, okay, so she's going to tell him at the feast. And so he's like, okay, let's bring Haman, and we're all going to come to the feast. So then they go, they hang out, they eat for a while. It says they're drinking wine, and at the end of the evening, then the king says, okay, what is it that you would like from me? What is your request? And she says, I would like you and Haman to come to another banquet tomorrow. And we're like, wait, why didn't she just ask him or tell him right there? But we don't really get told a lot of detail, but we see through the later events that God, through his providence, is working out certain things for his people's good. And so anyway, so the king says, okay, well, we'll have your second feast tomorrow. And so Haman leaves, and he's pretty ecstatic that he just got to have a feast with the king and the queen, and you know, he's feeling pretty good about himself. But as he's on his way home, he actually passes Mordecai again, and it says Mordecai doesn't really even care that Haman walks by him. He doesn't shudder, he doesn't tremble, doesn't bow, doesn't do anything like that once again. And then Haman once again flips the switch and is furious, but he goes home and he starts talking to his friends and his wife. And he's explaining basically how he's just furious, and that even though he has everything, right, he gives this really prideful speech about all the things that he has and how amazing and powerful and wealthy he is. But he says, but I hate that Mordecai basically is still alive. And so what his wife and his friends decide to give him counsel is, well, why don't you go and build a very tall gallows, which probably at this context would have been probably actually like a very long stake, which probably around 75 feet tall, that you can get Mordecai and impale him on it. So basically, let's build this thing, build the gallows, and then go to the king and ask if we can get him killed. And so he's like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. You go start to do that. And at that same evening, if you will remember, the king is going to sleep before this second feast, the second banquet, and he can't get to sleep. He can't fall asleep, and he's restless. And so he asks for some of his servants to bring in some of the chronicles of the kings, which would have been like some well-prominent events that have happened throughout the history of Persia and their royalty. And it's interesting, the thing that they pull and read to him is where Mordecai, if you will remember, saved him, the king. Saved this king. And then as he's reminded of it, he's like, well, wait, what accommodations or what reward did we give him for that great act of heroism, like of saving me? What did we do for him? And I said, nothing's been done for him. And he's like, what? And so then what he does, he's like, well, I need to go, and this has probably gone through the whole night now, because the next morning it says he's going in and says, who's in my outer courts area? And that's Haman coming in, because Haman was coming to say, hey, I'd like to kill Mordecai. Can I get permission? Well, that's the same time the king goes in and basically uses Haman and seeks his counsel. And so he asks Haman, what would be something good to do for someone that the king would like to honor? So he's wanting Haman's input. Haman thinks it's about him, right? Because if you remember last time, we talked all about his pride, right? And how Haman was so focused on self. And Haman basically gives him this long list of all the things he needs to do to honor the one that the king's wanting to honor, thinking it's about himself. And the king says, awesome, go do that for Mordecai. So then Haman is just, you know, mortified by this statement because he hates Mordecai. And so he has to go and parade Mordecai around the city and praise him, basically. And it leads to Mordecai, or to Haman just being, it says he has his head sunk. He's actually mourning, it says, as he goes back to his house. And then right as he gets back to his house, he finds his wife basically tells him that basically if you found yourself on the bad end of Mordecai, who's a Jew, that basically means that you're about to fall, because if you're against God's people, something bad's going to happen to you. And right around that same time, it says that the servants come and call for Haman to come to the second banquet. So now you see how it kind of started with Haman being elevated to now where he's upset. He just had to do something really humiliating for himself, and now he's being rushed back to this banquet that's obviously going to lead badly. It's going to end badly for Haman here. So that's where we kind of left off last time, is now he's going back to be at the second feast with the king and the queen after the king has had this revelation about Mordecai and remembering of what he did. So with that, let's read chapter 7, and it's only 10 verses, and then we'll just kind of go from there. It says, so the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And on the second day at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you, and what is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done. Then Queen Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given to me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, who is he, and where is he, who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? And Esther, Esther said, the adversary and enemy is the wicked Haman. So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, will he also assault the queen while I am in the house? As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman. Then the king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. So they bring Haman to the second feast, the second banquet, right? And they've spent the evening there, and maybe even thank Haman after being, you know, stressed and concerned about what's been going on. Maybe he was starting to actually get comfortable again and thinking, well, at least I'm at this feast with the king and the queen. And it gets to that point again during this feast where the king asks Esther for her request. And now finally we see Esther does make the request to the king. And what she asks for, I'm sure, would be surprising to the king, because he's probably thinking she wants, you know, some luxurious items, maybe some type of building, a palace, clothing, you know, jewelry, something like that probably. But instead, what she asks for, she says, I want my life. She says, I would like my life and my people's life to be spared. And she said, because my life and my people, we've been sold. And in fact, she explains and says that they are to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. In verse 4, it says that. And that's actually almost a direct quote of earlier of what the actual decree said. So the king is probably starting to recognize what she's saying, because she's literally using the same words of the decree that was passed already. But then, so she brings this up and she says that even if it was just that we were going to be enslaved, she said basically, if it was going to be just the Jewish people were enslaved and we weren't going to be all killed, I wouldn't have even bothered you with this. But the fact that we're all going to die, I had to bring this to you and bring this to your concern. And so the king, hearing this, probably wanting official confirmation, he's wanting to know who is responsible for this wickedness that is trying to assault the queen and her people. Which is, by the way, it's so funny, by the way, they've been married for years, and he doesn't even know who her people are, right? So this is her letting him know for the first time she's a Jew, right? And so basically she says, the wicked individual, Haman. And she literally points right to him, and you can just imagine Haman there in that moment, right? Literally sitting before the most powerful man in probably the world at this time, and he's literally being revealed as the one trying to kill the queen. And by the way, Haman probably didn't know that Esther was Jewish. So whenever he finds out, oh no, right? So he basically just is shocked, you know, probably fearful for his life. And it says that the king in his wrath actually gets up for a second and leaves the event and goes out to the garden area, probably trying to figure out exactly what he's going to do, because he understands that his decree is law. And so, like, once it's been passed, like, you don't reverse the king's decrees. And so he's probably thinking about, what am I to do with Haman, what this revelation of my wife, and in the decree that's lingering. So he goes out, and at this point now, Haman is pleading with Esther and hoping that maybe she will have some type of compassion or mercy on him and maybe somehow spare him. And it's interesting, by the way, if you remember where Haman was at. Haman, the whole reason this whole thing started, Haman was furious that a Jew wouldn't bow to him. But now it flips, reverses, to where now he is pleading to a Jew who's now a woman, who's actually would be considered lower than a Jewish man, right? So now he's actually pleading to a Jewish woman for his salvation, for forgiveness. And at this point, it says he falls over the couch area, because when they would be dining, there would be like they would lounge more so. And it says that he falls, he trips over trying to plead with her. And at that same time, the king comes in and basically is like, are you trying to assault my wife, my queen? Literally why I'm here in the house? Because there's actually a certain respectful thing going on at this time period where basically you weren't even supposed to be about 7 steps. From some of the king's women in the palace. So the fact that he was getting that close and fell over on the couch area, he's probably thinking maybe, he doesn't know what he's trying to do. He's trying to assault her in some way. So basically he says at this point, as he's basically saying that, how dare you do this to my queen in front of me? It says that his face is covered. So they probably put something over his face, which would have been common, as they're going to lead him to his execution. And then right around this time, it seems like one of these servants knew about the gallows that Haman's been building. And he's like, hey, by the way, he's already built this thing at his place. And then the king's like, okay, go impale him. Go hang him on the gallows. And if you've ever studied this before, it's really, really brutal on if it's the Persian use of the stake where they would impale. Because I don't want to get too graphic here, but basically you would put the person on this very sharp stake vertically, the body would be vertical, and they would be on the stake, and they wouldn't necessarily die right away. They would just slowly go down the pole, if you can imagine. And that's actually how you would die. And the reason that Haman originally did it, he made it 75 feet tall so that the whole city would be able to see Mordecai killed. So now just imagine, this is the shame, and this is the result of what happens to Haman after this wicked decree that he was trying to get passed and to occur. So that's what we see happening in chapter 7. And as we follow the next few chapters, we'll kind of see how it resolves itself with the issue still of the decree that has been passed still, and how are they going to deal with that, and what's going to happen to Esther and Mordecai and the king and the Jewish people. So we'll address some of those things as we look to the next few chapters. But within chapter 7, there's a few things I just want to draw from the story. The first thing that I want to kind of maybe point out is I think that this is a reminder for us as Christians is that we are to approach our King with boldness and humility. We are to approach our King, that is God. We can approach our God with boldness, but we should always remember to do it with humility. In Hebrews 4:16, it says, "Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in times of need." What our King does, what God does, is He actually grants us access to His throne, right? We see in this story where she is coming to the King, and she's going to approach the King and make a request to the King. Well, we as Christians, because of what Christ did, is we actually can come before our King, and we can actually ask Him for things, and we can make petitions, and it actually says to come boldly before the throne. That's just amazing to think about what Christ did for us, right? Because like, think about the story and how like serious this is and how terrified she is that she's even going to make this request, right? We've even talked that maybe the reason she didn't even make the request the first time was because maybe she was getting cold feet about asking because her King could be temperamental and certain people were killed if they didn't treat him or approach him the right way, right? And so, I think when we think about this, it's so encouraging that we are actually called as Christians that we can, it says, come to the throne, approach the throne, and do it boldly. And what that means is confidently. It's important that we can be confident when we come to the throne of grace. But it's important that we also remember that boldness, whenever I say it means confidence, that's not arrogance, right? We also still have to remember who we are approaching, right? So it's a good thing to be bold and confident knowing that what Christ did was sufficient, that we have this relationship with God now, but we also are not to ever approach Him and be presumptuous, right? Just to think God's like a genie or that, you know, we're going to name it and claim it and God's just going to have to listen and obey, right? We are still approaching a King. In fact, we are approaching the King. We are approaching the God of the universe, the maker of heaven and earth, right? The Ancient of Days is who we are approaching. So it's this balance of confidence because of Christ, but also having humility as we approach Him. And if you will remember in Revelation when we studied this in chapters 4 and 5, it describes the throne of God, right? And I just, as I think about it more and more, that is the throne we are getting to approach. When we come to Him in prayer, when we come to Him in singing and in praise, right, we are approaching this throne. And if you remember, it describes the throne as having thunder and lightning all around it. And in fact, all of those who are in heaven in that throne room are like bowing down because of His magnitude and His holiness, right? So like, it's intense that they are coming before this throne. It's a serious thing. But it's also so powerful in Hebrews 4:16 that when it says, what is the throne? It's a throne of grace. So that's kind of the balanced dynamic of who God is. He's this powerful, mighty King with thunder and lightning. But then at the heart of what comes out of the throne is grace. That's what the throne is. That's who God is. He is a God of grace. And so we can actually come to Him in humility and respect. But we also know that He is offering us gifts of grace. That's what grace is. It's a gift that we don't deserve. And so unlike a lot of the kings at this time, we have a King who says, come to me, let me know what's going on, and I will give you grace and help in times of need. So that's powerful, I think, that we recognize that we have a King who offers us this throne of grace. We can approach it. But we are to always do it with boldness and humility. And I bring this up because in verses 3-4, as I said, Esther, we see petitioning her king at the time, her husband, right? She petitions the king, and I think that we see her in verses 3 and 4 doing it both boldly and humbly. In verses 3-4, I want to read this again. So then Queen Esther answered, so this is her answering the king, and she says, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king." First off, think about that. Literally how she starts off the whole thing is she's approaching him and saying, you know, if I found favor in your sight, basically if I'm someone that you find that you would like to give honor to or respect to. And she says, and if it pleases you, if it actually makes you happy. So that's how she's starting the whole request, right? And then it goes on and she says, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. So that's all she's asking for. She could have asked for lots of other things, but she's asking just simply for their life to be spared. And then in verse 4, she shows how humble she is by saying this, for we have been sold by my people and I to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue. Think how humble that is. She's literally saying, as she's coming to the king, she's saying, basically, I wouldn't have even bothered you. I wouldn't have even wasted your time if I was going to go into slavery. Now, most of us probably wouldn't wait to be bound and put in slavery before we would start crying out and saying, hey, we need some help. I need you. We have requests to be made, right? We would approach the God's throne way before that, right? She's saying, I wouldn't even have wasted your time if we were just going to be enslaved. But she said, because it's going to result in the complete death of all of my people, I have come to you with this request. So I think that that's so important that we see how Esther petitioned her king. She came boldly. She was brave. Confidently, she went, and she was probably very precise with what she was going to say. She knew exactly how to articulate what she was going to request. And I think it's so important that we see this, because Esther could have said things a lot differently, and it probably would have resulted way differently. Could you imagine if she, because by the way, remember, the king is guilty in this. The king was kind of really dumb, because he literally got the information from Haman, didn't ask any questions, and basically gave him all authority to go and do whatever he wanted with them. He didn't even take any time to consider, who are these people? What are the laws they're breaking? What is the new law? Where are they? What is the actual threat here? Why are you motivated? Why are you trying to pay me off? He didn't even think to ask my wife, my queen, where her background is. He didn't even know his queen was a Jew, right? So the king is not faultless by any means in this, but she doesn't bring up any of that. But imagine if she would have started, hey, you need to save me because you owe me, because you're not very smart and you've made this horrible wicked decree with Haman, and now it's going to kill my people, and you need to spare them, right? And you've already said that you'll give me up to have your kingdom, so I'm requesting it now. You owe me, right? Imagine if she's tried to say it like that. How do you think the story would have ended? They all would have been put on the gallows, right? Everyone's getting killed, right? See, so it's important, I think, that we think about how she approached. Not just that she approached, but she approached the king, and she did it with boldness and humility. And I know this is somewhat connected to last time's message, where we talked about pride and humility, but I think it's another theme that we continue to see within the book. And I think it's important that we as Christians should not just think about approaching God with humility, but also we should approach all people in all things in humility. There's a quote that I recently read. It says, the more proud you are, the less proud you think you are. I'll read that again. The more proud you are, the less proud you think you are. What that's saying is, basically, you're a really prideful person if you think that you're not a very prideful person, right? So if you're like, well, I don't think I'm that proud, that is evidence that you are someone who is proud. Right? But what we're seeing here, I think, is this message and reminder of humility, right? We see the different paths of Esther and Haman in this story, and I think it's a result of those who are humble versus those who are just consumed with their own hubris. And it's important that we do humble ourselves before our God. Think about this. We don't deserve anything in this world. So many times, especially as Americans, we feel entitled to things. We feel like we deserve it. But here's the thing. Here's just a list of things we don't deserve. We don't deserve to be happy. We think we do. We think we deserve it. We don't deserve to be happy. We don't deserve to get married. We don't deserve to get pregnant. We don't deserve to get a promotion at work. We don't deserve any of these things. The only thing that I can think of that we deserve is the cross. That's what we actually deserve. And when you think then about this, the God of grace, the one who is on the throne, the fact that he has given us anything, and really he gave us everything through Christ, right? He's given us everything. That should humble us. When you realize you do not deserve anything, But instead, he not only gives you salvation, he gives you opportunity to be a part of the kingdom, that he says you can come confidently and boldly to the throne of grace, and also just anything else, like the clothing on our backs, the cars, the families, the relationships. All of these things are gifts of grace that we just don't deserve. And so it's so important that we just humble ourselves and recognize this, that we take our eyes off of ourselves and we look to Jesus. That's what humility is. It's where we stop thinking about ourselves and we just are so thankful for Jesus, that he has made all of these things possible, that we can actually approach the throne of grace. And there's one other quote that I saw that I thought was really helpful when it comes to humility. It says, "Humility is not thinking less of yourself. It is thinking of yourself less." And I think that's also helpful. Is we just need to stop thinking about ourselves so much. It's not thinking, "Oh, I'm a terrible person. I hate myself." It's not that. It's just stop thinking about what's in it for you all the time. Just say, "I want to fix my eyes on Jesus. I want to do whatever Jesus is calling me to." And I think that is how we are to live and relate to our King. We are to approach him with boldness and humility. So that's the first thing. The next thing I want to draw your attention to is I think we also see in this text that our true identity is found in God. Our true identity is found in God. In Genesis 1, 26 to 27, it says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.' So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them." So obviously, I know many of us know this text. This is just God creating humanity. And what's so important about this verse is what he explains is that we are made in his image. We are all image bearers of God. We are made in his likeness. And as Ecclesiastes reminds us, in our chief end, the purpose that we have been made in his image is that we would then relate to him, that we would find our purpose and our fulfillment in him. So literally our whole identity, the reason that we exist, is because of God. That's where our identity is found. And I think it's so important that we recognize this, because so many times we also forget this. We put our identity in race or in color, nationality, gender, sexual orientation, accomplishments, accolades, economic status, political affiliation, or even religious denomination. We use all of these different things to describe who we are. But ultimately it should be we are one in Christ. That is our identity. It is, we are in Christ. In Galatians 3, 27 to 28, "For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There is neither male nor female. For you were all one in Christ Jesus." That is our identity. It's not any of these other things that we so often can get politicized and separated and categorized, or thinking that we, based on our status or what we accomplish in this life, that is who we are. That is our identity. That's not what it is. It's we are in Christ. That is our identity is in God. And it's interesting because in this chapter, what we see in verse 4 and verse 6 is that we see for the very first time in this book that Esther is identifying herself as one of God's people. Now, that doesn't mean that she didn't know this before, but this is the first time, because remember, from the very beginning, she's been told, keep your relationship as one of God's people a secret, right? She says, Mordecai said, don't let people know that you are one of God's chosen people. And so this is the very first time in verse 4 where she says, my people, which is the people of God, Yahweh, she says that is the people that are at risk. So she's actually identifying herself as God's people. She is finding her identity here in God, and she's boldly proclaiming it to the king. And I think as we recognize that our identity can be found in God, we also see that there is true safety in our relationship with God. When you find yourself and say that really the most important thing is that I am God's person, that I am a part of God's family, you find true safety and refuge. In Exodus 14, it says that the Lord will fight for you and you shall hold your peace. This is a reminder that when you know that you are in God and God is in you, He will actually fight for you. He will protect you, that you will be able to be still and find peace and refuge in Him. And I think this is exactly what we see starting to happen for Mordecai and Esther, right? Earlier it says that they all started to fast for a period of time and depend on the Lord. And we see here that she's saying, and I am a Jew. I'm a part of these people. Likewise, Mordecai boldly starts to say who he is, that he's a Jew. So we see them recognizing who they are. They are in God's family. And then as soon as they start to do this, we see how God starts reversing all of these bad things. He starts to deliver his people. And I think it's so telling, and I've referenced this briefly earlier, but in Esther chapter 6, verse 13, listen again to what Haman's wife and his friends say to him. Esther 6, verse 13, it says, "When Haman told his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, 'If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but you will surely fall before him.'" See, this is them recognizing, as they start to see the events unfold, if he's really a part of God's family, if he's God's people, then you have no chance. And that's what they were starting to see. They even were expressing how they had faith in who Yahweh is and what he was going to do for his people. They're saying, "You're going to fall." And if you remember, that's exactly what happens. He literally falls before, in front of the queen. He's trying to, you know, beg her, and he falls. Right after they say this in chapter 6, this is exactly what happens in chapter 7. So literally the same night that she makes this almost, you know, prophetic statement. And so we see that Haman's wife and friends were warning him of God's people, that they are dangerous when they have God in their camp, when God is with them. But I think that means it all comes down to whether or not we are a child of God. Right? Are you a part of God's family? If so, you know that you have God on your side. You know that you have someone who is your advocate, who is working on your behalf. But the thing is, if you don't have God on your side, then that means you're against him, right? If you're not for him, you are against him. In John 1, verse 12 to 13, this is how we can know. It says, "But as many as have received him," that is Christ, "to them he gave the right to become children of God, to those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God." If you have received Christ, if you have believed in his name and his work, you are granted this great honor to be a child of God, to be a part of his family, his people. And so we know that if you are with him, and if he is for you, then who can be against you? And that is exactly what we find going on. So as Esther and Mordecai are recognizing that their identity is in God, they then find their safety. And so likewise, we need to remind ourselves of that. And the final thing that I want to share for this evening is that I think we also see this reminder that we are to be prepared to die, actually. Be prepared to die. In Luke 9, 23, Jesus says, "If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me." Now that's a verse I'm sure many of us are familiar with. It's this reminder that those who want to follow, chase after Christ, they must deny themselves. They must die to themselves. And this is a daily thing. It's that we are to be prepared to experience death of these things. So that means that our hopes, that means our desires, our plans, even life itself, are not things that we are to be grasping onto. They aren't things that we are to be bound to. Rather, we have to make sure that there's nothing in this world that we will not relinquish to God if he calls us to it. We must be prepared to give up anything and everything for Christ, for God. Because in Galatians 2:20, we find that our life is Christ. When we become a Christian, our life is over. Our life is now Christ. In Galatians 2:20, it says, "I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. In the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me." So what he's saying is, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, it is Christ who lives. And then finally in John 12:25, we see that abundant life is found in death, actually.
It says, he who loves his life will lose it, and he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. The reason I bring this up is because, when you look in this story, we see that there's two individuals with two different perspectives on their life. You have Esther in chapter 4, verse 16, who makes the statement, if I perish, I perish. And she knows she's going in knowing that very well her life could be over. She's not holding on to her life. She's not holding on to her possessions. She's not holding on to her comfort. She says, I'm going, I'm surrendering everything at the mercy and grace of God. I'm not going to hold on to my life. I am prepared to die for others, for life, for potential salvation, for my people. I am prepared to die. But in verses 7 to 8, I want to see on the flip side, how different is Haman's perspective compared to Esther's? In verses 7 to 8, it says this. Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther pleading for his life. For he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. And when the king returned from the palace garden for the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. So we see here how she says, if I perish, I perish. And she's basically going boldly then to live a life to honor God and to intercede for her people. Haman, on the other side, is only thinking about himself. And it says that he is clinging to his life. He loves his life. He loves his possessions. He loves his wealth, his power. He doesn't want to lose any of this. He's saying, please, please, give me my life. Give me my life. And she says, if I perish, I perish. That's the different perspectives here. But we find that whenever you are willing to die, whenever you don't cling to this life and grasp on to this earthly, temporal existence, you find that there's actually a deeper life. There's a greater, abundant life that is available, and that's exactly what Jesus came to give us. And in fact, Jesus came to die. He was prepared to die so that we could live. And that's the message for us is, are you willing to die to self, die to this life, so that you can have everlasting life through Christ? Or are you that person that's like Haman, that's clinging on to all of these temporal things, the pride of life, and you're going to miss out on true life? And so I think that's another thing that we can learn and take away from this message is you look at Esther saying, if I perish, I perish. And we see that she is exalted and lives in the end, whereas Haman is all about the riches of the world, the pride of life, and it results in his ruin at the end, where he actually truly dies. Those who love their life die, and those who hate their lives find true life.